Morning, Stuart. Good morning, Tracy.
Morning, Megan. How are you this morning?
Doing okay. How are you?
Not bad.
It's Monday.
Yeah, Monday doesn't make any difference to me in a positive or negative way. I'm really fortunate that way. I sort of feel like I don't work too much, and so when I go to work on Monday, I don't feel like I'm going, If I didn't like what I was doing, I'd do something else.
That's a good way to be for sure. Let me share my screen here.
Morning, guys.
Hey, Tracy.
Morning, Tracy.
Too many windows open. All right. So we just have this one question today. It's a good one. The question is, are organic acid tests useful slash accurate? If yes, with what kind of condition or illness would one consider taking such a test? So this is a seemingly simple question with not so simple an answer. The short answer, I think, is organic acid tests can sometimes and kind of be useful, but that's an incredibly unuseful answer. So I'll expand on my thoughts there. So organic acid tests, for those who don't know, look at metabolites of certain microbes and biochemical reactions in the urine. So they're not really looking at anything directly, but more so metabolites. And the idea is if something is high or low, it can tell you about a deficiency, an imbalance, or a faulty biochemical pathway or microbial liver growth. Some common things on organic acid tests are yeast and bacterial overgrowth markers, nutritional deficiency markers, detoxification and glutathione status markers, markers that supposedly look at mitochondrial function, and also some urinary neurotransmitters. Now, how useful and accurate the test is depends on the specific marker that you're looking at. Unfortunately, many markers are, at least as far as we know, clinically irrelevant. I think a lot of the companies selling organic acid tests include a greater number of biomarkers just to make the test look more impressive. And the vast majority of the markers are probably not going to be super clinically helpful in most contexts. I'm particularly not impressed with the neurotransmitter metabolites, which a lot of people get excited about. Just because, and this doesn't necessarily mean that they're not helpful, but urinary metabolites in the urine of neurotransmitters are coming from neurotransmitter production in the gut. We don't know of any kind of association or lack thereof with the amount of, neurotransmitters in your brain. That's a very invasive procedure to have to look at that. And we don't really have any evidence that I've seen, at least, suggesting that urinary neurotransmitter metabolites are a good proxy for what's going on in the central nervous system. Apart from neurotransmitter metabolites, some other markers like those for yeast and Clostridia overgrowths and certain B vitamin deficiencies can be clinically useful and relevant. Some of the markers that look at things like glutathione status, methylation abilities, and detoxification aren't really specific enough to be that useful most of the time. That said, sometimes looking at certain organic acid markers in the context of everything else, like other test results, along with a given individual's symptoms and history, can be helpful and allow for a more targeted approach. Like any test, I would ever, take an organic acid, test results at face value. I would want to interpret them in the context of the individual. But ultimately, I think while some markers can be useful, I'm far less excited about the organic acid tests today than I was a handful of years ago. And it's probably one of the less evidence-based tests that people in the functional medicine realm use. But given more research, especially in healthy populations, I would be very open to a different opinion because I think it's, the idea of the test is cool. There's a lot of, tests in the functional medicine realm that I think fall into a similar category. We don't have, you know, enough evidence to support all the markers or the test model yet, but the idea is quite interesting. There may be some clinical usefulness of organic acid tests in autism. So Bill Shaw or William Shaw from the Great Plains Laboratory and others have published in this area. Dr. Shaw has been on the MBT podcast in the past, but even then the sample sizes in these studies are small, and I've mostly only seen associations presented. There was one case study of a child that was colonized with Aspergillus fungi as detected on organic acid test. He was treated with antifungals, and then subsequently all autism symptoms subsided, which is pretty incredible. And one other study looking at urinary neurotransmitter metabolites in autism spectrum disorder suggested that there may be some connection between them and autistic behaviors in some cases. There's also some newer associational data that we'll link to, suggesting that certain organic acid markers, specifically those looking at carbohydrate and amino acid metabolism, might be altered in the context of metabolic syndrome and its complications, which is interesting. But I think that that's most likely an effect of metabolic syndrome rather than an actual cause. So I wouldn't be necessarily looking to treat those markers and having metabolic syndrome, get better. I think it's more likely, the metabolic syndrome is driving those markers to be out of range, which makes sense based off of what we know about metabolic syndrome and what it does to metabolism. So stepping back, we know some things about organic acid tests, but there's a whole lot more that we don't know about each organic acid metabolite marker and what it means or what it doesn't mean for a particular context or condition. So at the end of the day, I think something like an oat may be helpful for certain individuals, and the results have to be interpreted very carefully on a case-by-case basis, and with the recognition that not all of the markers on a given report are going to be clinically relevant. It's definitely possible that certain markers that are not currently well understood or described in the literature will become clinically relevant in the future in otherwise healthy populations. But at this time, I don't get too excited about most of the markers on an organic acid test for most people. And that's all I have. So Tracy Stewart, anything from you guys, related or unrelated, is welcomed.
So you said those tests are measuring the metabolites in urine, and from there making predictions, if you will, or assumptions of what certain health parameters may be.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
I
Is this one of those things you could like pee on a strip or, dunk a strip into a cup of pee? Is that along the lines of what those are?
It's a urine test. So you take a urine sample and send the urine sample into the lab, but
you
I don't
it.
Believe okay. There are any urine test strips for organic acid tests. Yeah. The other thing that I guess I didn't say that I'll say quickly here now about those tests, and largely a lot of the tests in the functional medicine, if you want to call it that realm, is the ranges that are considered normal. I believe that a lot of those ranges are based off of the population that the lab sees, which is typically a population that's not super healthy. The people running these tests are people who have symptoms that want to get to the bottom of what's going on. I don't believe that a lot of the reference ranges, whether we're talking about organic acid, stool tests for certain bacteria. A lot of these ranges, I don't believe, are based off of healthy people in the scientific literature. So that's something to, you know, to keep in mind with a lot of these things too.
Yeah. Okay.
That's kind of a problem with any kind of testing where you're testing a Western culture.
If you go into Quest, same issue,
which is same why we tried to, yeah,
you know, create more optimal ranges looking at the, you know, the studies, but even those aren't perfect because, you know, still it's based off of the average person, usually Westerner, you know, and if you're looking at a athletic population, for example, you know, ranges may be a little bit different.
Oh yeah. All kinds of stressors for being in an athletic population, right? Plus the idea that, I'm just going to make a wild guess here, but a significant portion of people who consider themselves avid athletes are probably actually overstressing their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Probably, to some extent.
I mean, not from an ancestral health standpoint. Mm-hmm. Not that we can't respond to that, but that the level of hormetic stress or stressors that would be normal in a healthy human ancestral population probably wouldn't include the amount of effort that goes into people who are especially ultra endurance athletes or triathletes or, you know, anybody who's pushing those limits very far.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
So I have a question for you.
Sure.
And I feel funny because I don't have any idea how reputable the source is for this. I mean, I think they're somewhat reputable, but what do you think of the idea of culturing your own probiotics for things like L. reuteri, for Lactobacillus reuteri, like what's in BioGaia's Gastrus?
When you say culturing your own probiotics, like making, using yogurt, a tablet to make a yogurt.
Yep.
It should work. It should work just fine. And that's a very well-studied probiotic strain. So mm-hmm. I think if you wanted to take more of a whole food approach, you know, go for it. But I don't know if there would be any additional benefit, you know, turning a probiotic into a yogurt, other than you can continue using that yogurt to make more and more versus
right.
having
there's
to buy
a,
more and more.
There's a monetary savings, but also there's the yep. potential. So I'll tell you who this is from in a minute. I don't know what you'll think of this, what you think of this source, but there's a potential for getting a much higher dose of the probiotic when you eat a half a cup of this yogurt that's been fermented for 36 hours.
Okay.
Than there is what you get in a tablet or two tablets a day or whatever you're taking of the BioGaia.
I don't know. I think I would be interested to see if anybody of us has actually quantified that.
You mean the amount?
Yeah.
Yeah, the answer is they have. The person about now, I'll stop hiding the person, but I wanted to just because I didn't want you to have any reaction based on the person.
Sure.
It's Dr. William Davis who wrote, you know who he is?
He's the Wheat Belly guy, right?
Wheat Belly, but he also has a relatively new book called Super Gut.
Okay.
Which he's done. I mean, his stuff is not studied in a trial sort of way, but he has some experience with people trying his ideas and having good results, mm-hmm. you know, which is its own kind of science, right?
Yeah.
It's not, it's anyways. So yeah, I made a batch.
Oh. And any thoughts so far?
Well, the first batch they tell you is going to turn out like curds and whey, which it did. Okay. But its taste isn't bad. I mean, it's a sour, yogurty kind of taste, cheesy kind of taste. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really eaten any yet because I just finished it this morning.
Oh, okay.
So, and I'm
will
just,
this be
I'm
your first stint with dairy for a while?
No, actually, I've been eating more dairy for about the last month.
Okay.
With nothing. I mean, my system's not working right still, but no increase in symptoms like I have when I eat vegetables, for instance, that I can't eat green vegetables right now, which I'm not eating. I'm definitely eating more berries, more things with trying to find things that have, for instance, you said something about me and maybe not getting enough folate. So I did a little research and I haven't trying to eat some papaya, because papaya is a fruit that's pretty high in folate. Not that it's going to make up all the difference, but I figure any source that you can get that has food that has what you're looking for, right, or might be missing, then that's an increase, an improvement. I made one batch. I'm actually planning to make another batch today, starting today. Takes 36 hours. Okay. And because they say the second batch will actually turn out looking like yogurt. The first batch didn't. It turns out, well, I mean, if you just strained it, what's left, what the quote unquote curds, is pretty close to yogurt. But
interesting.
And I'm going to make the second
yogurt.
Oh, okay. Well, I happen to have an Instant Pot that's adjustable heat temperature, because they say one of the problems with using a yogurt maker and trying to do this is this particular strain of Lactobacillus L. rotari, it gets killed at 109 degrees.
Oh.
And a lot of yogurt makers and standard yogurt cultures are 110 degrees. And so you need something that's adjustable, a sous vide. I have a newer Instant Pot that's adjustable, so I was able to sort of dial it in with water in advance with a thermometer I thought was close enough to accurate to get it right around 100.
Very cool. So, well, keep us posted.
Yeah. What Dr. Davis said was, whereas one of these, I'm looking at the BioGaia that I bought to do this with, which of course is the crazy modern world, right? I decided I wanted to do this on Friday morning, and I was able to get Amazon to deliver BioGaia the same day.
and throw it in your Instant Pot, make a batch of yogurt, and have tried it within 2 days later. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I actually did closer. Oops, sorry. I did closer to 40 hours of fermentation. Darn it. Sorry, I'm in the middle of trying to cook. I'm going to take a 2 second break.
Of course.
Yeah, I did enough years of making my own yogurt from the raw milk source we used to have. And right now I'm eating some dairy and some yogurt particularly, but not a ton, and not enough to justify going back to making my own. And I'm probably not going to go back to getting the regular raw milk source. And then I'd be buying milk and what type of milk and all that. But I'm interested in this in the long term, how this comes out, Stuart. Like, if I am back to eating as much dairy and yogurt as I was a few years ago and still continuing with the probiotics, that maybe I would go down that route again of making it regularly.
Yeah, he's in his book and on his website, which they both cost a little bit of money to join, but not much. Like, his website, I think you can join the community for $25 for a year. And the book, if you have a Kindle, is, I don't know, $20, $17, $15. Supergut is the one that.
Oh, go ahead.
Supergut is the book that has these recipes in it. But the way I came across it was from a podcast, because I listen to so many podcasts. And one of the ones that I have is a podcast that's related to the health coaching school that Mark Sisson started.
Oh, yeah.
And Primal the health. Two women who run the school had him on their podcast and evidently are developing a class for their health coaches that's created at least partly in joint with William Davis to talk about what he thinks he's learned about some of these beneficial probiotics. And he clearly says, you know, I don't know why we get the results we do. You know, he's really clear about that. He's not like, oh, we get it because of blah, blah, blah. He's like, but what I can see is that, and anyways, you were talking about numbers. So that it says 200 million CFU on the bottle for one pill of BioGaia. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about 200 billion in a half a cup.
Okay.
So, and he claims that they have a testing method where they test it, and that 36 hours is the length of time they recommend to ferment it at. And that 36 hours, if you go beyond 36 hours, you actually get some die off, because the food source that they have you put some, either some raw potato starch or some inulin in the mix to give it food at the beginning. I'm not using raw milk. They actually don't recommend raw milk, just because of the issues of potentially growing something that's in the raw milk that you don't want. and they don't have any negative about it being pasteurized because it's just a medium to grow it. You're not necessarily trying to get whatever nutrients are in the raw milk. You're trying to, it's basically a delivery method for getting a high dose of Lactobacillus aureuri. Mm-hmm. I mean, of rotari. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. And he says, and he's got a couple different, and he does it like this. He goes, yogurt recipes, because yogurt is actually a specific thing according to the FDA. And he says, this really isn't yogurt, but now that he's called it yogurt for a while, he has a hard time switching.
And I assume there's some strains that works with better than others. I think we lost you, Stuart. But you're frozen in a cool position.
With his clothes.
Yeah, like peace sign. There you go. Now you're muted. Now you're muted, Stuart.
It mutes automatically. My apologies. I have no idea where my rant left off.
It's yogurt, but it's not really yogurt.
Yeah. Yeah. He just says it's more a system for being able to amplify the effects of getting the probiotic you're trying to do. And he has several different ones he recommends, and they are all ones of known studied strains. You know, he's not off somewhere doing something unusual.
Specific strains he recommends that work better for the with this process.
Well, for different things. He has one that he calls SIBO yogurt. That in his test in, and I don't, that's a good question for you, Megan. He talks about breath testing for SIBO. Do you have any idea what you think of that?
It's not perfect. It's far from perfect. There's a lot of false negatives. And if you really want to be comprehensive, it takes some time because you would do like a lactulose, glucose, fructose breath test, and it gets complicated. So the more substrates you use, it seems like the more accurate it is, but there is still the issue of, you know, a decent amount of false negatives. Yeah.
So what he said is experiences, and I understand where you're coming from, but that if he has people who test positive using the breath test, the test for, is it hydrogen? Is that what it tests for?
Hydrogen, methane, there's potentially one for hydrogen sulfide now. Yeah.
Okay. He just says that the people who make that, his experience is that he gets people to make the yogurt that he came up with that's quote unquote for SIBO and eat that yogurt for a month to 60 days that they go a half a cup a day that they go to being registering zero on those breath tests.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. If somebody registers something on the SIBO breath test, it's usually a real positive. So there aren't very many false positives, but, you know, if you were to take one and it was negative, we don't know.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's negative. Okay. Yeah.
Do you know, but, do you remember what strain he was recommending for the.
I can tell you once I've finished reading the book.
Okay.
Because it's definitely on my list because I think a lot of my stuff might be small intestinal based. And this just happened to be the first one I learned about. So I ran right out and started doing it. It just didn't. I mean, one of the things he says, and you're kind of. You have to think anything else is that there's a low downside. There's a low side effect problem to doing this. I mean, other than you get it contaminated, right? Or you try and make it from your own and over time it becomes contaminated.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other potential downside would be some people don't do well with large doses of probiotics. So ramping up, you know, 200 billion or whatever you said, maybe like way too much for some people, at least at first. So, you know, with something like a yogurt ramping up slowly for certain people might be beneficial. And with probiotics, more isn't necessarily always better. But sometimes it is for some cases.
Yeah. So,
and I guess the lack
you can
of,
always go ahead.
Being able to quantify just how much is in there. You know how much you're starting with, and if the batches go on, what is the dosage versus what you're getting out of the bottle that you know more precisely?
Well, you know, it depends on whether or not you trust his research. his research says it doubles every 3 hours, and that their testing shows that that's about what you get. And so after 36 hours, you get 12 doublings. And he has you start not with one tablet, but 10 tablets in a quart of milk, and a couple tablespoons of probiotic inulin powder or potato starch.
Oh, so you're doing one tablet every time you do a batch?
No, you're doing 10 tablets in the first batch.
Okay.
And then you're actually using 2 tablespoons of your prior yogurt to make the next batch.
Right. Well, that's where after several batches in, don't you think that could be thrown off? How much is in each?
He said that he thinks that they're recommending. What I gathered from what I've read so far is that they believe that 2 tablespoons has more in it than the initial 10 tablets. And so they're, okay. What their testing shows is it ends up with, you know, he gave a number.
Sounds like he's not only testing the initial batches, but subsequent batches as well.
I hope so. You know, I haven't read enough details. You know, I haven't gone and read what he, you know, he hasn't, I don't know that he's written studies about it so much as he's studied enough to feel comfortable recommending it to the people he works with. You know, interestingly to me, his background was he's a cardiologist. And he was a cardiologist for years who was doing stent installation, ablation, and things to clear blockages in people's hearts. But he says it's the stats, the statistics, you know, he doesn't believe that statins do any good. I mean, he learned this while doing that, right? He kept seeing people, and then he said it sort of the key thing in his life was that his mother had a stent put in, and then a month later she died of a massive heart attack. And he just started thinking, like, is what I'm doing really doing anything good? And the result was that he decided to start an online community and start researching and trying to figure out what things could people do on their own without their doctor, because doctors weren't recommending the kinds of things that Megan would recommend, or, you know, food, health, lifestyle. And what could he do? And basically what he said is, after a couple of years of doing that and using that in his own clinic to give recommendations to people, he really doesn't have anybody who's had a heart attack. You know, he's got people who came to him as high risk people who already had heart disease and who end up, if they successfully change their lifestyle, often lose weight. They don't go into it trying to lose weight, but they end up losing weight. You know, it's not like my goal. It's kind of like not the goal isn't necessarily to lose weight. It's to be healthier, to have healthier markers when you measure whatever markers. And he's looking at, you know, some of his markers are more functional medicine-ish. Like he's looking at particle size when it comes to LDL. But I had that test done once before NBT with particle size. And one of the things that ended up is that I was working with a doctor who was functional medicine, and because she's a doctor and functional medicine, she said, well, the standard of care is I have to recommend a statin. And in the same, she says, I know you're not going to take a statin, but I have to say it because that's the standard of care. And I can get in trouble for not saying it, which is super frustrating. But she also then said, but I do think, you know, your LDL is high and I'm not really comfortable with that. And I looked at the test results and I said, yeah, but it's all large particle size, which may or may not be important. I realize we don't really know. But she went back and sort of dug in the functional medicine community and came back and said, well, I have to agree with you that if you're large particle size at the level that I was, which was almost all, she said, I don't think you're at risk, which is what Dr. Davis is saying. That he's not that he's saying you're not at risk, but that's what he's seeing. I mean, I think this is more of what he says is that it's like, this is what I see in the patients, and this is what I'm seeing in terms of them getting a recurrence of heart disease. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I never, you know, some people are so, well, we need an RCT to demonstrate anything, but I think the clinical experience of people like him and others is very valuable.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think what, not that he's trying, it's always difficult, right? He's complaining about the drug companies and them driving the medical system, or the money driving the medical system. And I think it does, but he's still trying to make a living, right? He's still selling books. He's still recommending, you know, he's still involved. Like he makes a probiotic that's that's I think it's got the same thing as BioGaia does in it, but it's got some other stuff in it. I don't think he makes it. I think he was involved with the company that makes it. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name right now. I'll try and remember to get it.
I'd be surprised. Go ahead.
It's called Gut to Glow, if you want to look it up. And because one of the things he sees is, he said in testing that MIT did with L-Rotari, that the mice that they tested, this was in mice, they, one of the things they noticed was a just an amazing transformation in their fur from an MIT study, that and increase in collagen in the skin and health of the skin. And improved healing of the skin. And he says that, you know, he's got patients who see the same thing. He also has patients who don't.
Yeah. Looks like it's L-Rotari, different strain. There's, I would be very surprised if he could get the BioGaia strain, because that's patented by them. Marine collagen, hyaluronic acid, astaxanthin.
Yeah. I mean, they're all things that we know are probably good for you, right?
Yeah.
And he's got some specifically reasons why he likes marine collagen instead of bovine collagen. Not that he thinks bovine collagen is bad. He just thinks there's some, he said there's structures in the marine collagen that we don't metabolize them. And so we just absorb them and then they be used directly rather than having to be reassembled. But, you know, I don't know if that's true. Anyways.
Interesting. And I did find a little bit on his SIBO yogurt here, so we can link to this in the, it looks like it's the BioGaia strains and then a couple of other strains as well.
Yep. And he talks about either making it as a batch or making it in separate batches and mixing it. Mm-hmm. He says if you make it in separate batches, then you can kind of do your own control, where if you make it in a batch, it's all mixed. If you then make subsequent batches, you don't really know what you're growing, because one may dominate over another, or there may be a shift where you don't get the mix the way you want it.
Makes sense.
I mean, to me, everything he said kind of makes sense, like as a possible thing that works. And it's clear that it doesn't work for everybody, but along the lines of one of the things that you say is, if you're not, depends on how sick you are, whether or not you're going to get a benefit from some things too, right? Mm-hmm. He's definitely worked a lot with sick populations. Go ahead, Tracy. Sorry.
Oh no, it's a low hanging fruit, as far as it's not, you know, it's not a high, it's not invasive. You know, there's no harm in trying, like you were saying, maybe except for if it gets contaminated as you're going on batches of brewing or fermenting for 36
and
hours.
And I would probably be tempted.
That's low.
I would certainly be tempted to figure it's worth the cost of 10 pills to restart every so often.
Sure.
You know, if you did that every third month, and every 3 months or 2 months you created a new batch, you would still be spending less money than, or maybe not, with the milk that you buy. I don't know, depends on the milk.
Yeah, that's true.
So
anyways. I am getting, when you were talking about the additional testing you had done for your LDL, for your, when you were testing your lipid levels, I'm getting the ApoB test and the coronary calcium scan.
Oh, okay.
In the next few weeks. And more, less about, because of concern of the cholesterol levels, which, you know, LDL and total are high, but I think more it's because I'm likely starting hormone replacement therapy and they want to have an idea of what those are prior to starting, because of some of the risks associated with that, and throwing in the family history and some other stuff. So, you know, they made a point to say, it's not like, if I weren't doing that, the numbers are not that alarming. But I'm, even aside from the hormone replacement therapy, as I'm continuing a higher fat diet, I am glad to dive into it a little deeper to know what it is right now.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I think I mentioned last week that I listened to a podcast with Minnie Pell, who wrote Fast Like a Girl. And when I'm reading both these books, Super Gut and Fast Like a Girl, which one is William Davis and one is Minnie Pell. And when I sort of synergistically think about combining some of the ideas in both books, there's interesting things there. The one of the things I really like about Mindy Powell's book that I've been reading, and I'm not going to get very far into it because I plan to try and write a detailed question for you, Megan, based on some stuff I've read in her book about fasting. But one of the things I really like, and Megan has sort of said the same thing, is that if you sort of intend to start fasting or start a fast or continue a fast after, by not breaking it in the morning, you know, listen to your body. Because there are days when your body just doesn't want to fast. And she's really clear about that, as saying, you know, you should never feel bad that you didn't accomplish the fast that you started out to accomplish. You know, that there are going to be times when your body doesn't want to fast, and that other times where it's like totally happy to. And I've definitely, I played with that this weekend, because I did a like a 16 or 18 hour fast on Friday night to my breakfast Saturday. We lose you, Megan. Oh, your dog's making noise. And then on Sunday, I thought, oh, I'm going to maybe do a longer fast, like a 24 hour fast. But it didn't really, I'm guessing I didn't really get enough calories on Saturday. But the other thing was, I had some things happen on Sunday morning while I was fasting that probably shot my cortisol up, some stressors. And that was just disastrous. I mean, the minute that I think I got stressed out about other things, that derailed any idea of being able to continue fasting. My stomach was totally unhappy with that. But I definitely agree with the idea of don't tough it out at that point. It's like, okay, it's time to make food and eat.
Yep, I totally agree. And it's interesting, the stress piece. You know, if the stress hormones are increasing the amount of glucose in your system, you may not be able to run as well as you would otherwise on ketones. So that's another, you know, interesting piece of the whole stress physiology when it comes to fasting.
Yeah, if the cortisol shoots up and you generate a bunch of glucose, you're not fasting anyways. I mean, you're fasting, but you're not getting the effects you want of fasting because there's sugar in your blood. And Mindy talks about that for sure. So.
So Megan, I started adding psyllium husk to my daily routine, along with still taking the sun fiber. And I think I'm noticing some benefit. I just started kind of ramping it up. I was reading you're supposed to do a 10 milligram or 10 gram dose. And the scoop that came with the powder was like, it said that it's supposed to be 5. When I weighed it, it's about 3 at the most. So once I realized that's all the tiny that I was taking, I've been upping it, and it's not the most pleasant. It's definitely chugging a glass of sludge.
Yeah. I've heard it you know, described as like you're drinking cardboard.
Cardboard might be better.
Oh dear.
And I used to do Metamucil for years and never found it. I mean, it's not appetizing, but it was fine. This is worse, definitely, especially in the 10 gram dose. But any thoughts on taking it with a meal, like, is that too much liquid sludging down as you're trying to digest your food?
I don't think so. You know, as long as you do want to take fiber, whether it's soluble or insoluble, with, you know, some water. But as long as you don't feel like it's too much, I think it's probably just fine.
And does it matter if it's without food? Is there any benefit either way, or just when it's convenient? As long as it's with a lot of water.
I don't think there is a reason to take it either with or without.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you're probably splitting hairs at that point. So if you're more comfortable, like volume wise, taking it away from a meal, I don't see an issue with that.
And I know the same with the sun fiber I've thought of before, you know, they're not calorie free, not that I'm concerned about the calories, but as far as just taking them at various times throughout the day, does that break a fast? I mean, that does break a fast, I guess, with migrating motor complex and trying to go a few hours without any calories.
I suppose maybe, but I wouldn't be concerned about that. The only other thing I was thinking about, no, I would have to look at the science around this and the physiology, but some people use psyllium in particular and sun fiber as well to reduce cholesterol absorption. So in that case, you may need to take it more with food, but again, I would have to look at the mechanism of how it's doing that, because I don't. Dietary cholesterol is only really a drop in the bucket as far as your actual total cholesterol. So I'm not sure on that, but that would potentially be, I'm happy to look more into it. That would potentially be a reason to take it with a meal or at the start of the meal or something like that.
Yeah. And that's part of, you know, for both my constipation issues and cholesterol, I know it can potentially help with both. So,
yeah.
So you're saying though, it's the absorption of the dietary cholesterol, the amount of cholesterol that's in the food?
I don't know. Okay. But that's what I would have to look at.
Yeah, I'm less concerned about that also, even cholesterol-wise. Yeah.
And I don't actually think so, because dietary cholesterol is only a small amount of contributing factor to your total. Yeah. So it may be I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Do you want me to submit something for that?
Yeah. If you want me to look into it, I'm happy to. I was trying to see if I can find it real fast, but yeah, it's working through bile, and cholesterol, like recirculation, which is what I was thinking. But yeah, if you want me to talk more about the science, go ahead and submit a question and I'm happy to go through it. Then I can pull up some, some graphs and not graphs, some images and stuff, and it'll be easier to explain that way.
Okay. I'm working through bile and cholesterol recirculation, meaning not so much the absorption of the cholesterol from the food item, but how it gets processed then thereafter.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yep.
I will submit something, but just trying to wrap my head around it for the moment.
Yep.
I don't think I'm going to be here next week, so we'll make a note to do that later.
Okay.
And as far as splitting the 10 grams into two doses, that shouldn't matter.
No,
twice
that
a day
should be fine.
Once.
Yeah, I don't see why you have to do it all at once. Yeah.
And is there any downside in too much fish oil? Would that just get not used? But is there any harm in taking too much if it's a day that I ate some fatty fish or had some salmon and took a full dose, or if there's a day I take two doses, does that matter? I just started taking the liquid. It actually tastes fine.
Oh, good. Which one did you get?
It starts with a C, one of the ones
Carlson,
you... Carlson, yeah.
Okay.
And it's a plate. It's like orange,
lemon
natural flavor.
Orange, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear it's palatable at least. It's unlikely that you're going to overdose. I wouldn't worry about it. In theory, yeah, maybe. But there's not a lot of science supporting that. So with the amount you're taking, I would not worry about it.
Yeah. Okay. And did last week's, I don't think that turned in last week's episode here. I don't think it got onto the podcast list.
I don't know. Elaine will be listening or watching this. So,
okay.
She will, if it didn't, then, I'm sure she'll
okay.
upload it. Yeah.
Thank you, Elaine. There was a chunk of it where I'd asked about some input on my friend who's been struggling with weight loss and health issues. And I wanted to listen to that. Every now and then I'll pull out and, or, you know, go onto the office hours site on your page and watch a bit, but usually I listen to the podcast if there's something I want to re-listen to while I'm doing something else. And that's all I have.
Okay. Stuart, anything from you?
Sure. When you talk about eating some ginger, and this could go to Tracy too, but you might, I don't know who has the better answer. Tracy, you're just chewing some raw ginger before a meal. Mm-hmm. Megan is very negative doing some of that with a, what do they call it? It's a little ginger candy, but it's the first ingredient is ginger because it's just ginger and sugar that's left to sit.
No.
It's just a way to make it a little more palatable.
Yeah, ginger is pretty pretty potent by itself. But no, I don't see any.
I'm kind of mixing it because I'm taking a slice of real ginger and then I'm taking a little bit of one of these little candies, yep. And putting them together and chewing them. And that gives me a little mm-hmm. sweetness to go with it. And the amount of sugar involved is a gram or two of you know, and it's cane sugar or it's just sugar. It's just like, okay, well, that's not a big deal.
No yeah. problem with that at all.
Yeah, it's one of the things I really like in Mindy Pell's book about fasting is that a big piece of what she's talking about is improving your metabolic flexibility, the ability to go in and out of ketosis. It's not about being in ketosis all time. It's not about, you know, it's the ability. She says it's really, you get a lot of value. She thinks you get a lot of value out of going back and forth. So,
yeah.
Which makes sense. And it's, oh, that was another question I wanted for you. If I go overnight, don't eat 12 hours or maybe only 11 hours, and then I eat a big breakfast, and then I go skiing, but don't eat again and ski all day, do you think I end up in ketosis by the end of the day?
Sorry, overnight fast, big breakfast, ski, are you in ketosis at the end of the day?
Yeah, like if I go,
how long?
Eight or 9 hours after I ate breakfast?
Potentially. Probably. A smaller amount, at least. Depends on the amount of carbs for breakfast. Depends on how hard you're skiing. But yeah, I would say you're probably registering some ketones at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, because my experience last week, I did this and actually had one of the best results in terms of how my gut felt when I skied hard was that I ate breakfast and there was a long gap. It was 4 or 5 hours before I started skiing. And then I skied for 4 or 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And at the end of skiing, I felt great. It was amazing. I mean, I also, that's sort of a key factor for me about thinking I'm in ketosis is I kind of get euphoric. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, oh my God, this is fantastic. Give me this drug some more.
Yeah, so, I would bet that you were definitely registering ketones then.
Yeah. So actually makes me want to play with that more where I work out fasted or at least work out some length of time after I eat that's longer than I have been. Mm-hmm. Not that I have a real negative, but it's like I was doing my skiing regime to try and make it so I got enough calories. I'm kind of thinking now about trying to pack calories in the previous day so that there's like an excess of calories the previous day compared to what I think is normal. And then I get up in the morning and eat a decent sized breakfast. But then I was eating again right before I'd ski. Mm. And that it wasn't terrible, but it didn't work great. It was just carbs. It was just fruit and rice that I was eating before I skied. But I didn't get the same effect. I would get hungry again 3 hours into skiing. Whereas the day that I did this, and I did this 2 days last week, and I had good results both days where I would eat breakfast. And then it was a longer gap before I skied. 5 hours, 4.5, 5 hours, and I didn't eat anything else except for, you know, water. Well, water with salts. I'm always piling in the salts. I've actually upped the salt content of my mixture in my water. So
I always find if I don't have protein, I mean, I haven't tried the let me, you know, build up the bucket the day before, and not so much right there, but if I'm going to eat before working out, if it doesn't contain protein, then I'm going to get hungry mid-workout. Like if I just had rice and fruit, I think that might almost be harder, be a little worse than having rice and fruit and protein.
Yeah, that's when I do that, Tracy, and I don't know if this could be the same effect you're talking about, but I will eat at like 5:30 in the morning, I'll eat a half a pound hamburger and I'll eat some rice and fruit. And then at 8:30 before I go skiing, I'll eat some more rice and fruit to add some calories in. But still, I definitely do not. I had a much better result when I ate the breakfast early in the morning and then started skiing a little bit later, like 10:30 or 11. So now I've got 4 or 5 hours in there where I haven't eaten anything except for drank plenty of liquids. And I just felt like my body kicked over. It really felt like after an hour or two of skiing, I kicked into ketosis, and then I got that sort of euphoric boost of everything going on good at that point that you get sometimes when fasting goes well. So, and I was mostly curious because it's not long enough for just a regular fast to do it. But I thought because you're working out, maybe it would kick you in because you're like chewing up energy. You've got only so much readily available sugars. I'm not got a whole lot of extra energy on board anyways, because I'm not, I'm heavier than I was, but I'm still not, I still feel like I'm kind of dancing around too little calories, not enough. So yeah. Cool. Yeah. I think that's it for me.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Well, so next week I'll be riding mountain bikes in Sedona.
Oh, great. Have a great time. That should be really nice. I hope the weather's good for you.
Yeah, it looks decent. Not as I was hoping, 75 and sunny, but it looks very doable. Actually, we're going to be between visiting family in Las Vegas, Prescott, and Sedona, and all those places are between 50 and low 60s, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, sunny. Personally, I like low 60s for mountain biking. When it gets to 75 and sunny, it's too much for me. I mean, not that I don't ride in it, but it's just like, oh God, this is really warm. Because once you start working, I have no problem staying warm in 65 degrees. But yeah, at this point, I'm coming from skiing so much that my body's completely adapted to staying warm. So, which changes in the summertime, hopefully, because otherwise I'll be overheated. Yeah, all right, well, have a good time down. That's a beautiful part of the world to go mountain biking.
Yeah.
I've spent some time there, but that was before I was mountain biking. But as I hear it, it's supposed to be
amazing. Me too. I'm in Vegas. I've been to many times with family there, and we usually go rock climbing in the area. I've never mountain biked in Vegas. And the time I spent in Sedona was, 20 years ago. So I'm not biking then.
Yeah, Interbike used to have some mountain biking outdoor activities related to it in Las Vegas. I know there were two areas. One is, oh God, like without a map. Maybe if I get a chance to look at a map, I'll throw them out there for you. I don't know if either one of them is really a good mountain biking area or not. You have plans to ski to do it there or just in Sedona?
Not sure. I mean, we'll have the climbing gear and the riding stuff. Vegas is more of a climbing destination. And mountain biking does exist. And what I've looked up, it looks more than perfectly fine. It looks like what we would do if we were anywhere else. It's just known for such good climbing.
Yep.
And because we're splitting just over a week between three places and wanting to actually spend some time with family, like time is going to be limited to do these things too.
Yep. Yeah. Time equations are a pain in the butt. All right. Well, have a great week. Have a great trip, Tracy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Have fun next week, Tracy. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.